This is another Table Talk by the Microdosing Institute. Through this platform, we offer education, community, research, and coaching so that people like you can explore microdosing in a safe and responsible way and with maximum benefit. Before we dive into this episode, as one of the co-founders, I wanted to share one thing. If you are thinking of starting microdosing in the near future, or if you are a coach or a therapist who believes that their clients may benefit from microdosing, we have an offer for you. Our video course, Explore Microdosing, is the most compact, comprehensive, and hands-on video course available now. In just over 2.5 hours, it guides you step by step through a detailed process of understanding the science and framework, and then your journey of preparation, optimization, and integration. You can enroll anytime and follow the course at your own pace. And you will also have free access to our community and our community meetings every month online. You find it on microdosinginstitute.com or through the link in our Instagram bio, and look for the video course Explore Microdosing. Okay, so today we're sitting here in the studio with Casper van der Meulen. And Hein and I, we know Casper because we have a bunch of similar interests. And one of them is, of course, microdosing. So that's why, we sat down here for a podcast.
Yeah.
So welcome, Casper. You are known on the internet and in the world as the breathwork biohacker. And you teach people how to breathe. You teach coaches how to become a breath coach. You wrote a book called Mind Lift, which is an international bestseller at this time. And I believe you traveled the world quite extensively to do all of this. And you integrate a lot of other teachings into your work. And from that, so from people who've seen Casper online, they might have him heard talk about focus, about body awareness, about flow states, about so many things. So I look forward to dive into that also today. But it seems that you're also on a mission. So maybe you'd like to introduce yourself and your mission a little bit more.
Yeah, no, that's a great introduction. I am definitely on a mission to teach people, to help them be the best version of themselves, to be healthier, to be more self-aware, live more aligned with what works for them. And I'm very pragmatic, basically take on any tool, anything that works is fine, which is kind of the biohacker way, is whatever works. And so for me, things like microdosing are very obvious tools to use, because it's just there and it works and it's so simple. And one thing also that's really part of my personal mission as a teacher is to clarify a lot of the things that to me are obvious, that are like out in the open, that are overlooked. That's also what fascinates me the most, is to find the things that people are overlooking, that they're not using, and then to show them how to use it, which is one of the main reasons I got into breathwork, because it was only one of the topics that I was really interested in and working on, but it was the one that most people had really overlooked in their practice, and especially athletes or like high performers of all kinds, they seem to not be aware at all of the impact of breathing on their quality of life.
Yeah. And how were you introduced to breathwork? Because I know it's a very ancient, like the yogic sciences and the old yogis, they focus a lot on breathwork. So how did it come into your life for the first time?
Yeah, no, it's been around. Well, I was working as a biology teacher, as a science teacher in a school, and a lot of children were suffering with all kinds of anxiety issues and test anxiety and worries. And I was just looking for ways to help them cope with being able to do a physics test without having a panic attack, which is difficult. I mean, I used to struggle with that as a kid as well. And I started trying to understand why this happened, why just normal, healthy children from good families and everything, they have no control over their mental states and they just suffer and they have such a hard time. It has to do with identification and with demands and with the school system and all these things, but I couldn't change that. But what I did realize I could change is the interaction with their physiology, and if I could help them gain more control over their mental and physical states, they could feel better. And yeah, one of the things that I got interested in was meditation, concentration exercises, self-hypnosis. These were the things that I was using in my own practice. And then later on also just a little bit of breath work. I was a little bit interested in it. And I saw that it worked. So that was kind of the first step. And then as I was writing my book, Mindlift, I wanted to add some things that were kind of out there and more cutting edge. And then I got really excited about the Wim Hof method. This was before it was... right now it's almost commonplace, but then it was pretty out there.
Right now, people like my mom, who's 68, and all of her friends are into Wim Hof and taking cold showers.
That's
and,
a good thing. It's a very good thing. I'm very excited about that.
And because so I went, you have worked with Wim Hof also. You've followed the trainings and that.
No, I used to work with Wim, and I used to teach the instructor's course together with him, and it was a really good time. But it started there with just a workshop that I did, and I came for the ice, and I wasn't really too interested in the breath work at that time because I hadn't really heard much about it. I knew what breath could do, and then that was my first kind of deep breathing experience where I was like, whoa, this is something. And after that, I just got fascinated and started diving into also like the more ancient yogic sciences. And yeah, just there's so much out there. And then I was like, wait, this is just here? There's like medical textbooks, scientific literature, ancient literature. There's all these different techniques. There are all these stories of people changing their life with breath. And I was like, whoa, why didn't we know about this?
And the beauty is that you have your breath all with you all the time, so you can apply it anywhere you want. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And from what I've heard is that you've also overcome quite a bit of struggle in your own life. And was breath work also the thing that helped you flip that? Or could you talk a little bit more about that? And I'm actually also interested to hear a bit more about today. How do you make sure you are, feeling good and balanced and healthy today? And because we all have moments of like slight anxiety, or when we didn't sleep well, or we just coping with day-to-day life. So could you just expand a little bit more on that journey?
Yeah. Well, I've had struggles with anxiety, fear, panic for a very large part of my life, which also translated into me, just doing whatever I could to escape it, and overeating, and just escaping, escaping the present moment and numbing my feelings and being as far removed from my emotional and physical states as possible. That was kind of my game. So smoking, drinking, video games, whatever it was for me that could move me out of having to feel. So when I actually got into breath work, I was already out of the largest factors of distress in a way. I'd already lost weight. I was already living much healthier. I was working out. I was meditating. I had already gotten very interested in different mindset techniques to help get my mind straight. And so in many ways, I was already out of kind of like the darkest hole, and I was no longer depressed, and I was, through my first burnout and all this stuff. The thing is with breath work is that it allowed me to get in touch with my feeling on a much deeper level, which was really the next step. And it's funny because if you see somebody go from being overweight and depressed and unfocused and just spending time playing video games and smoking and drinking, and then 5 years later you see somebody who's lost weight and they're like more energetic and they seem to enjoy themselves more, then you're like, oh, that person has arrived, they're there. But for me, actually, that was only the starting point. So crawling out of the dark hole and just being at a let's say average level of health and well-being, that to me was the starting point. Then I realized, wait, healing, personal healing, self-development isn't something you do to go from bad to normal. Well, it is. You can do that. But for me, it wasn't. When, as soon as I was at the normal state, kind of like, okay, I was like, wait, what else is there? And then I realized actually that healing and self-improvement is a path that you can stay on for your entire life. So that's when I got into breath work, which is really to me about optimization, about learning to control my body at a completely different level, to feel my emotions much more deeply. And nowadays, it's actually a very simple, very minimal practice where I am so in tune with my breathing that it can tell me about my state and what I need. And if I listen to it, which I don't always do, sometimes I'm like, yeah. But most importantly for me, if I listen to it in the morning, I check in with myself, I see to which degree my nasal pathway is open. I see to which degree my my breathing rhythm is aligned with my heart rhythm. I try to feel if my heart rate is variable or not. And if it's easy for me to hold my breath or whether it's difficult. So,
and that you do that just checking in with yourself, tuning in with your body, not going straight into apps or trackers or...
No, exactly. No, I first check myself. Yeah. Now, the first thing, I always want to have the internal measurement. And then I check my data. I use the Oura Ring to track my sleep data and my HRV. And then I check whether I'm correct. And I'm actually usually a bit more strict because sometimes I realize that, my nervous system is not where it needs to be. And then the ring tells me, you're fine, you're good to go, which is also nice to have sometimes.
Okay.
But it's very important, especially breathing for me is when I wake up and then I do a little breathing scan, a little self-assessment, and then I know what I need throughout the day. Then the practice is, of course, to actually give myself what I need throughout that day. But
that's such an essential question. I see this. I also constantly ask myself, and I, with coaches, also work on this. Like, ask yourself the question, what do I really need? What does my body need? Yeah. What does my nervous system need? Where can I, kind of like this body scan type of thing.
And so sometimes you don't know. And that's the difficult thing, because if you're looking from the mind to the body, then you're looking through a mind's lens to the body. So the information that you receive comes in through this mind's lens of like, it's probably fine. Because if you have this mental idea, this mind idea of, I need to be productive, or I need to reach these goals, or I have all of this stuff. And then it's really the practice is to listen to the body from the body. But it's kind of difficult because it's a mind thing to do.
From the observer, if you have your different selves and you see it from one self, and you say, hey, I'm fine, I need to eat, and I'm going to go to the refrigerator, going to eat a lot of stuff, and then your body scan has to be from your body itself or from the observer who
and that's a good point, because it's like the part of me that wants to just get up and kick ass and do work is that character within me. If I let that one look at the body, it's like, it's fine. It's good to go. Just throw some extra stimulants in and let's go.
That's also the trap of getting a burnout, because you're constantly focusing on the productive side of yourself. And so you're constantly on and going on. So
you can see the breath in that way kind of as reading the symptoms. It's kind of, if somebody... If they're trying to read when an earthquake is going to happen, they have this tiny little needle, and the needle makes these movements. And these tiny little movements, they tell you everything about what's going on below the surface, and which is a huge process. All these different things going on, and you have this tiny little needle to tell you. That's how I think the breath is the best way to use the breath as an assessment tool, is to really take each of those little movements seriously. That's a very intricate process, because before I used to, five, 6 years ago, I would wake up and no matter what, I would just get up and just do a bunch of really intense breath work, like 30 minutes like going for it and blowing my mind and having like psychedelic experiences. And that was like the start of my day. And now I just feel like I don't need that anymore. All I need to do is to know where I am. And depending on what I read within myself, I decide what kind of breathing intervention I use, which is usually the smallest amount that I can find. This is a very important principle for me, is minimum effective dose. What's the smallest amount of anything that you need to get the result that you want?
Yeah, that's also what our mentor and friend Jim Fadiman always says, also about microdosing, that less is more. So constantly searching for less, as less as possible to get the most benefit out of it. But is that also why you call the breath the remote control of your immune system, that you can regulate it and control it and fine-tune it like you said, like the scanner or the...
I think the nervous system.
Nervous system.
Or the nervous system, sorry.
Nervous system. And then also a little bit of the immune system. But yeah, the nervous... Yeah. One thing that I really learned by sitting down and watching the breath very carefully, and especially also actually through coaching people, which is interesting because I learned more about my own breath by seeing other people breathe than by watching my own breath. But that's also kind of how I learned, because I'm a teacher and I learn through teaching. But I started to notice that you don't need to do much to make a change internally. And there's, I had heard these, read these stories about these swamis and these ascended masters in the yogic practices who could decide which nostril was open and which one was blocked. And they could decide the changes in body temperature of parts in their body, you know, and this was actually measured in a laboratory. And it didn't seem like they were doing much breath work at all, but they were doing it with the breath. And that's what fascinated me, to look like how, what is really the smallest, the tiniest little trigger that you can use. And that's this perspective of the breath as the remote control of the nervous system. Also comes from this idea that we have this top-down, that's what we're just talking about. From the mind, you look at the body. From the mind, you control the body's top-down approach, which is very powerful, and it works. And this is what, like,
and it's what we know, right? It's what we do
exactly.
All of our lives.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the whole point. That's what we've been training for. Imagine just being a kid and you want to in school and you want to move, and then the teacher goes like, "No, make yourself not move." Well, it's a top-down approach.
Yeah.
I'm now much more on a mission of understanding what is the other direction, and there is a different direction, but the cool thing is that you do get to start from here, because you have to actually think about, oh, I'm going to change my breath. So that is a top-down approach. So you kind of like send a message down, something changes, but then you have to actually be very careful and very aware, very open to what then actually changes, and to read that and interpret that and understand. And then this kind of like communication line starts to happen. I call it, sometimes I call it relationship therapy with your own body, you know, just like saying something, seeing what happens, like trying something, seeing what happens.
And this is exactly also what we're doing with microdosing coaching, basically encouraging people to track all the changes that they notice as soon as they start microdosing. So their energy level, their sleep level, their pain level, relationships, stress level, just everything they perceive, just track it, give it a number, and do that for a while, because this is still the top-down method, but it's like it, the numbers tell you if something is changing.
Yeah.
And then you circle back, and what do those changes mean to me? How does this affect my whole life, or different parts of my life? And how can I circle back to, and compare it to before I started microdosing and before I started tracking all of this, so that you can see like, oh, my body's actually learning and my system is learning, and I'm working with my own data and continue to improve this relationship.
Is that why you also got interested in microdosing itself, like the mechanism of microdosing, implementing in what you do with the breathing and all the things you do?
I just get interested in things because I just get interested in things. I just have that all the time, like the most random things. It's funny, like out of the topics that I share online and in my teachings, it's only a tiny tip of the iceberg of all the random shit I get interested in.
What's the most random thing you came into recently? Like what this week or so?
This week, I have to think. Oh, past lives is something I got interested in this week. Past life regressions.
Okay.
But in general, this is actually fairly in line with the work I'm doing. But for example, like I know an exorbitant amount of facts about sperm whales, for example, or about the giant squid. It's like flutes. I build flutes. And it's like, all this. Well, which is, again, kind of related to breath, but I have just all this random stuff. But now with microdosing, what I find so interesting about it and what I notice with it is that it's just something that I was going to try. I was like, you know what, I'm just going to try it. And I had a certain expectation the first time I tried a microdose, which was just with a truffle. And I had heard that it was good for focus and creativity. So I was like, oh, I'm going to have super focused day and I'm going to be creative. And then I took the microdose and for the first time in a long time, I felt like, nope, I'm not going to do any work. And it felt really weird. And it felt really frustrating because I was like, no, I was going to do work. Because normally I just drink coffee and I just like, go. And it made me realize, and this was just like the tiniest little dose, because I was kind of like, just like a lot of people who start, they're afraid like, oh, is it going to be weird? You know, so I took like the smallest, I took like 1/15 of an active dose. And
of magic truffles or?
Yeah, truffles, yeah. And then I just sat there and I was like, no, I'm not going to be productive today because that's not what I need. I'm going to take a nap. I'm going to walk in nature. And then I sat down on this bench in the forest and I started doing breath work. And it was the first time in a long time that I was actually able to go very deep into my breathing practice. Where I was like, hey, this is very interesting. Yeah. Because for a while already, and this was around a time when I had been overworking myself for quite a few months, because I just had the book coming out in America and I was touring and I was traveling and I was guiding retreats and I was going all over the place. And I just hadn't taken the time to actually sit and process all of that, because it was all fun. It was all amazing. It was all great. You know, it's all like positive stress. I'm like, yay, I'm doing it. It's working. Yeah. And then I thought the microdose was going to allow me to do even more of that. And then it was like, nope, just sit, take a nap. So it allowed me to actually listen to the wisest voice within me that actually knew what I needed. And it really, really nudged me into a different direction. And then when I started combining it with breath work, I was like, yeah, there's something here, because I finally had the body awareness. I realized that one of the reasons that I wasn't getting the effects that I was looking for with my breathing is because I was more and more having an idea in mind, in my mind, where I wanted to go with it, instead of actually listening to what my body needed at the time. And that's also one of, around that time, my teaching shifted from showing people how to blow their own minds and have these spectacular experiences to actually tuning in with themselves and being very subtle and very careful and very relaxed and really like, what is really going on? What do you really need right now?
That's really an important point for microdosing itself. So with at Microdosing Institute, if we have people with big expectations about microdosing, then we narrow it down to the realistic viewpoint on tuning in what you really need. And the beauty of psychedelics in general is that it gives you what you need, not what you wish or want. That's one of the insights that you gain. So you,
but what is it? What is it with humans that we tend to have like high expectations of almost everything, or that we actually strive to have those kind of mind-blowing experiences? So both for psychedelics and with breathwork and Wim Hof, like it became so famous because he showed the extremes and he showed like what's possible. And psychedelics now, the psychedelic renaissance, is basically based upon the idea that it induces a mystical experience in many people under certain conditions at certain doses, etc. So that is still what kind of draws us to these practices. And it's so funny that then you have to go through this whole journey to actually discover it's on this level. It's really tuning in inside yourself to what some people call the inner healing intelligence or the natural healing intelligence.
Natural healing system.
And reach homeostasis and see how we are getting closer to that. And that's such a fine,
Well, I think it's important. Because, well, there's a few things involved there. First of all, we learn to live our life in normal waking consciousness, which I believe is a very unnatural thing to do, to spend as much time as possible in normal, waking, productive thinking consciousness. And the only altered states of consciousness that we are allowed to access are, well, winning. That's one of them.
Successful.
Get a quick hit from reaching something that you're supposed to reach, but only things that are useful to society. You know, like make money and gain status and these things. That's an altered state of consciousness that we're kind of told to have. Then there's drinking alcohol, which is kind of stupid, but we get to do it. Yay, it's fun. And then people don't realize that like coffee is a psychoactive drug. And a lot of times when I lecture on microdosing, I compare it to coffee. And well, you could compare it to alcohol, but that's just not fair game anymore. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows alcohol is just going to lose. It's just,
yeah.
But if you compare it to coffee, I tell people that if you drink coffee, you're in a significantly altered state. You're really under the influence of a heavy psychoactive drug, one that matches 100% with our normal waking consciousness and with our productive states and the things that we want to achieve. So that's why it's condoned. Actually, coffee played a huge role in the building of the modern world that we have now. Mm-hmm. Michael Pollan wrote a great book about it. That's one line is, coffee is helping us to keep up with the world that coffee made us create.
Wow.
Which I'm like, yeah, exactly. You know. Yeah.
And you see that now with the whole specialty coffee culture. And, you know, it's like it's even becoming more amplified now in our culture.
Exactly. And all the other states of consciousness that we know and that are naturally available to us, they're very often in a taboo corner. Yeah. Like even just sexuality. Like everybody does it, but don't talk about it.
Yeah.
And also, you're not supposed to talk about it as an ecstatic experience. It's like transactional. So it's, again, it's reaching a goal. So our whole consciousness in the modern world has been built around having that endpoint, the point of achievement, and going to that point of achievement. And if you have the point of achievement, then you will have happiness and you will be ecstatic and you will feel love and you will feel all of these amazing things. So it's this goal-minded, carrot on the stick type of thinking. But it's a very unnatural thing. So I think that people have a drive towards ecstatic experiences, real experiences, just like the rise of, like there's a documentary called The Rise of the Sufferfest, which is about people who go and they run these mud races or ultramarathons, which is also something I used to be into, which is also about this drive of going into that altered state of like suffering and going through it and then feeling amazing at the end. Not because you've achieved something, because like you could have not ran through the mud for an hour or 4 hours and felt great. But at the end, there's like, you know, you've been through the struggle and you've made it and you're back to normal, but you're better for some reason. So I think that seeking these extreme experiences is an important first phase of snapping out of the normal waking consciousness. It's the first step, because if you go to an ayahuasca ceremony or you have a high dose of mushrooms or you have a very intense breathing session or you do a tantra workshop and you experience sexuality at this ecstatic level, like whatever it may be, it is the perspective shift that moves you out of your normal state and gives you a whole new view of the world. And my kind of like, this will probably be one of those like breath is the remote control of the nervous system type of things that I'll keep saying for many years, that I realized a few months ago, is that in the beginning, people always ask about how do you integrate a psychedelic experience? Well, in the beginning, you have your normal life, and then you have a psychedelic experience, which is completely outside of the realm of your normal life, and you start to integrate that into your psychedelic experience. And the same thing goes with, you know, a breath work or like from all these different things. But and then after a while, if you've had enough of these experiences, it actually starts to turn into an opposite process. Instead of integrating your psychedelic experience into normal life, you start to actually disintegrate your normal experiences. And you live on a level that is much more connected to this open, aware, psychedelic, you know, transcendent state. And that is when you no longer need these really intense experiences and need seeking and all of these different things, because you can just be there for
the
most
cycle of remembering who you are, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's an interesting way to look at it, because if you go in a ceremony or in the psychedelic, have a psychedelic experience, then you feel the connectedness of each other. And you can integrate that in your daily life, that you feel more connection with your parents, with your children, with the community of the community feeling of a session is very important to me, for instance. So microdosing helps me to get off the automatic pilot and really get more aware of how do I interact with my parents, with my colleagues, with my relationships. So that's what my experience with microdosing and psychedelics in general. So I noticed that you also in your trainings you implement microdosing also in your trainings. You understand? And how does that?
Yeah, I started doing that about 2 years ago at my. So I did a 5-day event for breathing coaches. Was the first time that I did it, I've been training breath coaches of different methods for many years, and I've been teaching all over the place. And now I decided to just have a 5-day event where I was just going to do everything that was unique to my style of teaching, because I didn't really have one kind of signature experience that is really specifically about all the things that I care most about. And so I was like, what if I would do a 5-day event where I only teach all the things that I am most excited about, and not just breathwork, but everything.
Yeah.
And then I realized that microdosing needed to be an important part of that. And so that's just for my own, because I wanted to share it with people. That was one thing. But another thing is that the faster, so if you go to a course, if you go to a retreat, if you go to a new experience, and you enter as your old you, and you know you're going to emerge from it as a new you, no matter, even if it was a horrible experience, or if you didn't even like it, or any, like, you're going to change.
Yeah.
If you go 5 days and spend time with people, yes, and on a new topic, you're going to change.
Yeah.
And I've done a lot of retreats with extreme nature, with extreme cold exposure, mountain hikes, fasting, like all kinds of crazy stuff, like extreme heat, saunas, and so I'm always looking for what is the fastest way for people to shift out of their normal way to look,
right,
in it. Because I know that learning,
yeah,
if the only way to learn, this is the interesting thing about cognition, so learning is about taking in new information. And the more you are your old you, the less ready and willing you are, your brain is, to open up to new information. So I just wanted a tool to amplify that. So that was an important thing. And I did it really from that perspective, from opening people to a more, to heightened cognition, to heightened creativity, to more body awareness. Those are the three reasons that I focused on it. And also just because I think if you're a coach in this day and age, you need to know about microdosing. It's just, you at least need to know about it, know what it is.
Yeah.
Because otherwise 5 years from now, it's going to be like the most normal thing, or it's going to be the biggest thing, and then it's already happening. And then you're going to feel like you've missed the boat.
Right.
And then when I started doing it.
Yeah, totally agree.
Yeah. And then when we started actually using it and implementing it, I realized that there was so much more going on, because every part of the process in my retreats is built to support a level of personal, let's say personal insight, but also personal transformation. Even when I'm just teaching science lectures, I'm not actually asking people to remember the information. I'm inviting them to completely revisit the way that they look at reality through the way that I teach a specific scientific topic like physiology.
Hmm.
So you get to know your own body, for example. And I realized that people were much more capable of embodying their learning experiences, even if I was just like doing a science lecture with graphs and numbers and like what people see as boring stuff, and it would profoundly change them more and more if we use the microdoses.
Yeah.
So then I started experimenting also more with actually doing breathing sessions where I would do less and less intense breathing to see how deep people could go with a relatively low amount of intense breath work. And then I realized that the microdose is a perfect, it kind of like opens the door a little bit, and then it's kind of like put the door on a little crack, and then people can decide to open the door completely and step in, or they can leave it there. And I think that's a beautiful balance to take.
Do you also, because I've been in some trainings for my educational NLP coach, and what you saw is that people are integrating all kinds of insights and opening up, and you saw a lot of divorces going on, people who quit their job, because it's a huge step. And sometimes in relationships, for instance, then your path of personal growth is not the same path as your partner, for instance. So you see that it's not a trap, but it's something to warn. Do you warn people about that?
I ask
and
them.
Also, like, is everybody ready for? How do you know somebody's ready for this? Like, or is that a different question?
No. It's a great question, because they're ready because they're there.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
But this is also why I think it's important as a facilitator of any modality not to have an agenda for the people you're working with, because a lot of times people measure how good of a coach they are by the extent to which the life of their coachee changes. But that shouldn't be the measure, because if I'm only a good coach if your life is completely changed by me, which means that I have an agenda to start to change your life, which means I might actually offer you more change than is right for you at the moment. So that's definitely one thing. Another thing is that I ask the people that I work with, why are you here? And they say, I want to learn. And then I explain, well, learning is changing. So you're here to change.
Yeah.
Like, well, yeah, I'm here to change. But are you really, like, do you know what that means to change? Because it's funny, because once you've seen a truth, you can't unsee it, you know?
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, especially if it goes into some really deep processes, like once you've opened up Pandora's box, so to say, you can't really close it anymore.
No.
Yeah.
So I think it's important to make people aware that they might end up wanting a completely different life. And it's happened also in my work. I do build safety nets around it. Like if I have a retreat with people for 3 or 4 days or 5 days, or sometimes a whole week, in the closing part of that, I tell them, don't make any major life changes in the next week. If right now you're 100% clear that you need to divorce your partner, and that is absolutely true, then it will be absolutely true a week from now.
Yeah.
Okay. Don't make any huge, like, and this is also some of the groups that I've worked with who work with plant medicine. They also, for example, they don't accept donations in the first 4 weeks after the retreat. Like, we don't want your money 4 weeks from now. If it still makes sense, then sure, we'll have it, you know. And that's really about integrity and about understanding that if somebody might have a profoundly mind-altering experience during a retreat, and it doesn't even have to be with psychedelics, just a sharing round.
Yeah.
Somebody shares their like deepest trauma, their deepest fear, and they heal. And in that moment, life is completely different, and they want to change everything. But then they come home, and they're like, actually, my life was comfortable. I'm happy where I am. I'm happy in normal waking consciousness. I don't need to walk this path of spending my whole life on like all these different things. I'm just going to be here and live a more fulfilled life in the life that I already had, which is great, you know? And that's also a very valuable thing.
Yeah, so the life-changing power of retreats, plant medicine, intense breath work. Do you think, so for you, like a retreat or having a learning experience, is that the most effective way of learning? And is that, and what would you recommend if that is not accessible to you, that type of learning?
Well, this is really, I think, there's two roads. It's a very important question because there's two paths. One of them is the 1% direction change. You know, this is like what lifestyle is really all about. Where if you imagine a cruise ship that needs to go to, you know, the other side of the ocean, if it's 1% off course or 1% on course, it's a massive difference down the line. And I think those changes are really underestimated.
Yeah.
I've also seen people who are like junkies. Well, you can't technically get addicted to psychedelics or to retreats or to mind-blowing experiences, but it is kind of like a habit of people always seeking another, I just need that one more mind-blowing experience, and then everything will be fixed, and they go back to their life and they don't apply, they don't integrate, they don't do the work. So I think it's a balance of both. I do definitely feel that having an experience, even just traveling to a country that you've never been to before and seeing a different culture, can be a profoundly mind-altering experience.
Yeah.
I just really do think that we should... I think it should be a more common practice in the West to seek out experiences that profoundly change your point of view and put you in an altered state of consciousness. I think it's important to actively almost reject normality in a way, because normality doesn't really serve us. It's not built for us. And a lot of people say, like, well, I want to change. I would love for all of the results in my life to change without actually changing anything of what I do throughout the day. And that's also the idea that is sold to us, that be the same person, keep doing the same things, but without the problems. Buy this, take this, take this, you know. And that's really how we're sold. And we don't learn to accept the difficult parts of it, the struggle.
To the extent even that if you ask people this question, you know, what if a miracle happens? And tomorrow you wake up and your life is completely changed. Like everything is different and it's the life that you've always dreamt of. It's what you really, really want. What does that look like? And typically people cannot answer this question very well. That they say, I would just have more calm and I would get rid of my anxiety and I would no longer be depressed.
Yeah.
But that's like what you initially started talking about. That's that first stage that is actually for many people the end goal because they don't know that even more is possible. And I think this is due to the conditioning that we're like the constant state of kind of being brainwashed into this. Conditioning for normality, I would almost call it.
And it's comfortable too.
Yeah,
it's very comfortable how I live now, because if you see a snapshot between me 10 years ago and me now, 10 years ago I was depressed, I was addicted, I was smoking and drinking and whatever, video games, I was overweight, I had all kinds of injuries and chronic pains and all this stuff. And then now people see me and I'm like in better shape. I travel a lot. I have amazing people around me. I do the work that I love. I have all of these amazing adventures that I get to have in all these cool places. I hang around with, I feel like I'm surrounded by a team of superheroes. Those are the people I get to hang out, all this stuff, you know? And then if you look at those two snapshots of life, people assume that I am more comfortable now. Which is actually not the case. Because back then, I was actually way more comfortable because everything was controlled. I was just sitting in the same room, eating the same foods, doing the same things, thinking the same. I was miserable, but it was very comfortable.
In your comfort zone.
Yeah, and nobody thought I was doing anything weird.
Yeah. No.
That's another thing. I wasn't doing anything extreme. I was just a young guy enjoying life, you know, whatever, like a student doing what students do. And I was miserable. But it was very comfortable because nobody judged that behavior. Because it's very societally approved behavior to just do that. And
now you have to constantly explain yourselves on podcasts.
Which I love.
All the weirdness.
Which is amazing.
All the time.
Yeah, I love that. I love being interviewed, which is a lot of fun. But and then when I started doing like running a marathon on my bare feet or taking ice baths every morning or sitting in a circle of strangers and chanting Hare Krishna and, crying. And everybody's like, oh, that's so weird. Don't do the weird stuff. Just come back to normal life. Just be a fat, miserable, depressed guy. And, so it's kind of like, and that's also a thing that people, they see the results of that work. And then if you tell them the work, and then they're like, oh, man, that sounds scary. Yeah. And it is, which is amazing.
But the understanding of those kind of tools and like microdosing and also breath work, it's getting there. The stigma is being broken more and more.
Yeah.
We are also a little bit in our bubble, so we meet a lot of people who are interested in that. So we have to be careful to say that it's more mainstream. But especially with microdosing, it was a hype in 2015, but now it's getting more mainstream and people
it's also to me it helps that it's normal for me. It's just completely normal for me, and I think it's also important to show people how normal it really is to have a plant or a fungus that is literally growing out of the ground and to pick that up and to put that into your system and to support your system by something that you literally pick out of nature that we have co-evolved with. It is completely like both historically and biologically unscientific to say that is not normal. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah, we have been doing this for thousands of years, probably. It's in our diet, or else it would be gone already if it was poisoning or something.
Absolutely. And also, I mean, even poisonous plants that are very psychoactive used to be worked with by the medicine women of the West that used to live here.
Datura
But also just right here in the Netherlands, you know, it's like, I think it's 200 years ago that the last witch was burned. And those were the herbal healers and they just knew. And so all of that knowledge has also been deleted from our history and from our awareness. And I think that just the concept even that something that grows in nature, like a plant or a fungus, can be made illegal and that somebody can put me in a cage for holding a mushroom, it's a crime against humanity. But for most people, it's like they have never even thought about that. So when I speak to people about microdosing, what I like to do is I like to compare it to all of the things that they find normal.
Yeah.
Which is...
like coffee, for instance.
Like coffee, yeah. But Jim even beyond coffee,
also said there are people drinking coffee every day. Like it's similar, like, okay, we are doing microdosing.
And yeah. That's the thing. If you're in a train, like in the morning, you get into a train, there's easily 1,000 people in that train. 1 in 10 people in the Netherlands are on a psychoactive pharmaceutical medication. So if you're on a train with 1,000 people, there's 100 people who are in an altered state, who are high off of a drug that their doctor prescribed them, which is an antidepressant or a sleeping pill or an antipsychotic. That's 100 people in that train.
Yeah.
And then you have at least 900 people in that train, especially on a Monday morning, who are also on drugs, which is coffee or tea. And they have no idea that they're on drugs. So we're all sitting there in a profoundly altered state. Yeah. Everybody's on drugs.
Yeah.
And if I happen to be the one guy that had taken like a tenth of a dose of mushroom, I'm the most sober out of all of them. And then think that like that is something so weird and out there. And also like tell the people in my courses in the morning, I tell them about the mushroom, about the microdose, about what they can expect, and like lower your expectations. Not much is going to happen. And sometimes they ask me like, isn't this like out there? Aren't you afraid to do this? I was like, every course or seminar or like networking thing that happens at the end, they serve alcohol.
Yeah.
And it is completely normal to have one dose of alcohol and to go drive. But even with the one dose of alcohol, you're so far more likely to get hurt or hurt somebody else than even if you would have half a dose of mushrooms. You know, it's just...
Yeah.
And even if somebody would kind of accidentally eat the entire 15 grams of truffles, then still, like, even especially with truffles, not that much is going to, like, it's not that scary.
No. And but physiologically, it's completely safe and it's non-addictive.
Yeah.
So, it's just, can you handle it with your mind? That is basically the only question. But if you're in a safe place.
And that's also a very important thing I need to take on if I talk to this to Western normal, especially Dutch people who would like things to be normal. And I talk to these audiences that I have to back it up with a lot of comparisons, right? So you have something here that is non-addictive. It is non-toxic. It is just grows out of the ground. It's completely natural. Like even if you would accidentally overdose, you'll just have, I mean, there's this one review where they showed, where they interviewed, I think like 5,000 people who had once done mushrooms in some setting, in any setting, and then there was a percentage of people who said it was the worst experience of my life. It was a complete bad trip. I think it was like 10% or something. Yeah. They asked 2,000 people, and around 10% said worst experience ever. I might be slaughtering the statistics here, but out of the 10%, so the point is, out of the group of people that had the worst experience ever, also said it was one of the most important experiences of my life.
Yes. Johns Hopkins University had that. The most significant experience of their life.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's that's another funny thing.
Because we learn through challenge. So this was, you know, you could call it a bad trip. You could also say it was a challenging experience.
Yeah.
But that triggered so much in you, and you have material to work with, and you, that is also transformation.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's also what I tell my students. I'm like, if you ever accidentally take like a triple dose, you're in an amazing place. You're around like 15 coaches. Might have a hard time, but it'll be good.
Yeah,
and you couldn't say that for alcohol. You can't imagine like if you're planning to have one drink and then you accidentally have 20 drinks, you'll be in the hospital.
Yeah.
Right. And people end up in the hospital all the time like that.
Yeah.
So to me, it's just like really what I find important about is I'm not promoting, and people go like, oh, but are you promoting people taking drugs? And I'm just like, oh, this fucking question again.
That's not the point.
But the thing is, I'm not promoting anything. I'm just really asking the question of what do we think is normal and what do we think is good and what do we think is bad, because it is completely out of whack the way that we consider. I mean, there's between 17 and 20,000 people per year in the Netherlands die off of wrongly prescribed medical pharmaceutical medication or pharmaceutical procedures, but the largest part of that.
What's the number again?
17,000 to 20,000 in the Netherlands.
That is crazy. And it's that's quarter, insane.
It's insane. Seriously. Yeah, that's more than 1,000 people, right, per month.
Yeah.
yeah. that die for no reason.
And how many have ever died of, you know, cannabis, psilocybin, LSD?
Exactly, like, and that's the point. And in America, it's 250,000 per year that die. And the pharmaceutical thing is even worse there. And then I keep having to tell people, I'm not pro drugs, I'm not promoting, I'm not anti-pharmaceutical, I'm just pro logical thinking. Like, really, just look what's going on here. Like, what is happening? And these statistics, they don't lie. They're pretty scary. And a lot of people don't know about it. And this,
And I think you're touching also on a great point here. And maybe this is a nice segue into, some of the practical things that we, I'd like to ask you a few practical questions about microdosing. But it's also about, know what you're taking, know what it can do to you, and tune in with that. So, for instance, these days a lot of people are doing intermittent fasting, and so would it be wise to take your microdose, for instance, in the morning on this completely empty stomach, or would it be wise to take it later? And another one is, we also talked about coffee, like, and it, of course, a lot of people are sort of, you know, kind of married to their cup of coffee. They really like to have, you know, at least one coffee a day. So how do you, and I feel like here education is really key, that we sort of all understand, what does this do? What does that do? Should we mix it? Or should we sort of find our own personal, optimize our own personal routines based on what we know?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, first of all, I think in order to really feel what anything does to you, it is great to do it in a fasted state. But then first you have to get used to being fasted, of course.
Yeah.
Right. So then if you skip breakfast for a week and you kind of learn what your body does to that, or even an hour before you take breakfast. If you have breakfast at 9, you're not really fasting long, but you're in a fasted state when you take it. And then you can just sit with it the first hour. And this is also what I invite people to do who are very married to their cup of coffee. So instead of having the coffee and then running into your day, why don't you have the coffee and then take some time to, like, go for a walk or meditate and really see what it does for you, so that you understand how it works. And so I think for me, I always prefer having my microdose on an empty stomach, because then it comes on, and or it doesn't really come on. There's a slight state change. And then I know, okay, so this is what I got from it. Where do I want to take this? And then sometimes it feels really nice to eat, because I'm like, oh, today I need to rest. I might want to get some creative work done, but I'm not going to, like, go for it actively. And then I'll eat, because then that'll relax my system. And if I feel like, oh, this is a great state, I've got this creativity, I'd like to amplify this state and add more energy, I might have a strong cacao, because it then strengthens the effect and it also gives me a lot of energy. Or I might say, like, okay, so this is great, I might add some other supplement, like another mushroom, or, you know, like a lion's mane, is, I think is combines beautifully with psilocybin. And so it's really about finding your own way. But then in order to do that, you have to first be aware of what is already in your system. Mm-hmm. So if you're not, I think it's for a lot of people, it lowers the threshold to do a new thing if they don't have to change anything else. So telling people you'll have to be off coffee first and then you can microdose, they're like, whoa, buddy, hold on there, off coffee. And then, okay, sure, whatever, just add it, you know, just add the new thing and see what happens. But I feel like taking away other things that might get in the way of it, might not serve it, is also just a very good idea.
Sometimes the beauty of microdosing is that we always advise, or not advise, but say, don't change your routine, because with microdosing, you are aware of your routines, and then you start making better choices, healthier choices. So that's the plant medicine will also have its own role in that. And we were discussing with Jim Fadiman during podcast that in your guts, there's also the 5-HT2A receptors. So there they have, the psilocybin has an affinity with that receptor. It's in the brain, but also in the guts.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts about that? Do you have something to say about microdosing and having a role in the guts, or the second brain you have?
Yeah, I haven't really looked into that too much. I do know that a lot of the serotonin is produced in the gut, for example.
Yeah.
So it makes sense to have the receptors there. But it does, I think, make it a stronger point that the more balanced your gut is, the more quality you'll get out of it. And this is one reason that people that I like introducing things on an empty stomach, because there's nothing else going on. There's nothing else messing with the signal. And because most people are not used to taking state changing or state enhancing substances, they assume that they just eat and then they just feel normal, and then they eat and they just feel normal. But the more sensitive you become in your body, the more aware you become that everything that goes into your body has an effect. It triggers your immune system, it triggers your nervous system, it has certain release of certain chemicals, and you don't even have to understand all of those things. You can just sit there and feel it. Yeah. So I really like to have a very simplistic approach. And for a lot of people, that's the thing with microdosing, is that there is definitely stories of people to whom it's like a panacea, like everything in their life improves. And for some people, it just gives them like that 2% more awareness. Like there's not much going on, but I kind of like it. I kind of just have a slightly better day if I take it, you know. And and I think especially for those people, there's a huge invitation to study what that means. Yeah. What is that slightly better day? What caused it?
Yeah. Yeah. That's why we always said to keep a journal, because those really subtle changes, a lot of people don't notice it, and they just say, yeah, I don't notice it. And then when we get to talk to them and say, okay, what did change? Yeah, I had this, and I saw things from a different perspective, but they can't relate it to microdosing directly. And of course, it doesn't matter if it was the microdose that changed your perspective. In the end, it's all about getting a really good day and nothing more. But it's good that people get people aware of those kind of things. Like I had in my experience that I had more empathy towards my children. And it was not like hey, it comes through the microdosing, but it was after a month I started noticing, saying, hey, I'm really at the same level as them. And then I have an entrance of really connect with them. And I started to notice from my journals, like, hey, this is a subtle change in me that I found that interesting.
Excellent. Yeah, I also feel always that I actually need a medium to be able to observe what is happening inside of me, what's changing. Like, I don't ask myself the right questions inside my mind. I need someone to ask me those questions, or I need like a trigger, or I need to start journaling, because then you're like going really into conversation. I think we're like so good at avoiding avoiding certain ways of thinking or diving deeper when we're just
And that's the thing with the like Jim Fadiman wrote a book, very interesting one, Your Symphony of Selves. And I have it here. It's a beautiful book. You can read it. Do you have it?
No, but I
wanted to give it to
you. Oh, that's amazing. Because I just wanted to say that this is a part of his work that is lesser known.
Yeah.
But I saw a lecture of
him on book. This,
and it's like, it's extremely interesting to have these different selves.
Yeah. It's if you honor your different selves and you have more respect, and that's also what we say with clients who do microdosing, that if you're gentle to yourself and you have every self has a positive intention it's to avoid or achieve something. But if you respect that, then you can see that you are
part. Yeah, this has been a very important thing to me, because people, for example, they ask me like, are you no longer anxious? I'm like, well, which I are you asking? You know? Because if I consider my psyche to be a car or a bus, I don't know how many people are in there, then it used to be that the anxious person was the one who was in the driver's seat and was like, oh, we're all going to die. You know? And now he's just one of the passengers that's somewhere in the back seat. And every now and then he goes like, oh, but everything's scary. Yeah. And then
I'm still here.
Exactly, I'm still here. And then now I can actually listen to that part of myself and be like, hey, this anxious side of me only comes up under certain circumstances. Feeling the anxious part of me become anxious is a sign that I might have missed something. Maybe I didn't sleep well. Maybe getting that one email that I quickly answered maybe rubbed me the wrong way on hindsight. Or maybe, you know, whatever. It could be a conversation. It could be anything. Yeah. And I think that is a very important perspective which is very often seen as developed through meditation, right? To be self-observant and to be like, oh, now there's a part of me that wants to. And it's funny because like my girlfriend and I, we are very we both are very much into all of this stuff. And we literally, if we have conversations, and then it doesn't even sound like an argument, because like you'll say things like, oh, I'm noticing that the side of me that is afraid of this was triggered by the side of you that said that to, you know, it's kind of like, this,
like it becomes very it meta.
Exactly. And then it's a very meta conversation, and we're not, and it's not actually, sometimes it's also good to just have the fight, of course, but it's a very useful thing to develop. And I think there's a few things that develop this observer perspective, and meditation is one of them, and actively working with struggle and suffering, like ice bathing or like intense workouts or like anything that really puts you into the conversation with yourself, and to realize that you can stand above the conversation. And I think also that the psychedelics have a great role in that, even in a microdose. And that's what I kind of like in if you have a full dose session or ceremony or whatever, there's a point where you're struggling with yourself, and usually people come to a point where they completely rise above it, and they have a higher perspective, and they go like, oh, all of that struggling is no longer necessary. I was actually wondering your perspective on it. Do you feel that people who have had a high dose experience of any psychedelic, that they have better results in microdosing with the same substance?
I think the combination, or the a lot of people start with microdosing. They never had a high experience with a high dose. But on the other hand, a lot of people are into psychedelics in general are microdosing. But I believe in the power of the combination, and of that if you understand a high dose, then you also. You need less also of microdosing. Yeah. That's because you notice the effect
you
already.
It. Yeah. It's like you recognize it more easy. So I feel that people who haven't got any experience with psychedelics, they need a bit more time to figure out what is this whole microdosing thing doing to me. So they need to tune in much more, and they might be a bit off, or they have a longer journey towards, but I think in the end I believe that the result can be the same. The result is, in so many ways, it is really what does your system do, like how does it clinch onto the microdose and how does it incorporate, and that's of course like partially it's mental, emotional, psychological, partially it's physical. And then this whole awareness. So, and as your awareness grows, then where do you, up until where is it still the microdose, or is the microdose only a reminder of you know, like kind of compass? Where's the needle exactly going? Oh, okay, there it is. And then the rest is, I think, awareness and
that's a great point.
taking responsibility over your own life and all of that.
For me, it was microdosing helped me really as a reminder of all the insights I gained with higher doses. But because I like to say that if you have a psychedelic session with a high dose, all those insights will come like a hurricane and out of your daily routine. The power of microdosing is that you are doing it during your daily routine. So those insights will literally get on the surface because you have an example of embedded patterns you don't like, or the insights you gain. So it really helped me, and so those insights come like a fresh breeze instead of the hurricane. but in the end, after a month or 2 months of microdosing, then you can get the similar results and maybe more because you're implemented it in your daily routine instead of outside in a retreat with a community tribe feeling. What's really special, of course, but that's the thing. What you said about
disintegrating
your normal life, that's why I liked also maybe in the podcast you referred to a man who was in Auschwitz and had
Viktor Frankl.
Yeah. I was really intrigued by that. Can you tell me a little bit more about that? Because that's that mechanism of what he said, like the trigger and the reaction. Between it there, there's a space.
Yeah, that's his famous quote. Yeah, because he was a Jewish man in Auschwitz, which is kind of like the worst place to be. And he realized at some point that it didn't have to make him unhappy to be there. And then he found this space, and he says, you know, between stimulus and response, there is a space, and in that space lies our freedom.
Yeah.
And I feel that when I microdose, that space is naturally larger.
Yeah.
And if I would have to actually explain microdosing and like the functional aspect of it, like what do you notice of it? It's that. I used to always say like the wisest voice within me, the wisest, you know, self that I have, has more of a say around the table. And there's more of that space between stimulus and response. And if that's all you're getting, that's huge, you know.
Yeah.
And in that sense, it's also very different from, well, again, if we compare it to like coffee and tea, like caffeine, you know, it doesn't do that at all. It just makes you more responsive and more reactive. Yeah. So I think it's very serving. Because I also noticed in myself, that's why I asked the question, that when I started microdosing, it was always kind of like a mystery what it really done to me, or what it was really helping me with. And then after I finally had a few more high dose experiences, then I know exactly what is the microdose and what is not. Like I'm more tuned to it. Mm. And I've also found, like you said, I think that's a beautiful way to say it. It's like a reminder, where if I and it's funny because sometimes on a day where I take a microdose and I have it in my hand and I'm already feeling myself going into that state that I know I'm going to get from it. And then I'm like, do I still need to take it? I'll just take it anyway. Yeah. Yeah. And which is, of course, the amazing power of suggestion and repetition and placebo.
Placebo
and,
effect.
Yeah. To really, so that it's just, that's what I like about it, that it's not actively influencing me. And that's the fear that people have. Will it make me be weird? Will it make me do weird stuff? Yeah. Well, if you are weird, then it might. It might show you your profound weirdness.
Your weird side. Yeah.
But it's not an altered, like it's not like, you know, when you drink alcohol and you say something and the next day you're like, oh, I wish I wouldn't have said that. Well, I do that all the time without alcohol, but it's more that it's not that much. You're more of yourself in a way.
Yeah.
And it's not really an altered state. And also, I'm wondering if you could call alcohol even an altered state, because it is an altered state, but you're also...
You're also narrowing down. Serum.
Yeah, but with psychedelics in any dose, you're not really intoxicated. Yeah. Like you're, and that's also one of the teachers that I've journeyed with quite a bit. His name is Anthony Smith. And he says beautifully where drugs, or he says plant medicine or psychedelics, they show you the reality that is always there. They don't make you see things that aren't there. They just make you see things that are always there, but that you never see. And it also says very beautifully that a drug experience is to numb the pain and to escape reality.
Mm-hmm.
And with these medicines, these psychedelic medicines, it's actually to face reality.
Yeah.
So it's a completely opposite experience. It's not even the same category. And I think that's a very important thing to make people aware of.
Yeah.
That, you know, if I spend a weekend in a teepee in ceremony, people think that I'm just kind of like spacing out and not doing what I need to do and just kind of like escaping life. But it's the exact opposite of that. It's like, and if people who have that experience, I was like, I dare you. I dare you to come into ceremony.
Yeah.
But I think that's the what's happening now with all kinds of psychotherapy, with MDMA psychotherapy and psilocybin psychotherapy, that you go through the pain instead of numbing yourself with SSRIs or antidepressants. And through the pain, healing is done.
Yeah,
we have to. I think societally, in every possible way, we have to start embracing the dark side and the shadows and the difficulty. And
I was gonna say about that.
I think it's the most important task that we have ahead of us right now. We need to have difficult conversations with each other. And like it's funny where, like, for example, if I talk to people about ayahuasca, they go like, oh, but that makes you throw up, right? It's like the first thing they say, which is kind of funny. And I think, and I'm always like, well, I sure hope it does. And I think there's something very beautiful in being in a room, and it doesn't have to be ayahuasca, and ayahuasca can be very extreme where you hear people cry and you hear people throw up, and and to sit there and to realize that that is being human. Like I've also been in my own retreats, I've had people that were approaching hypothermia because they went too far in the cold, against my instructions usually, or people, they just break open and they cry and they sob, and there's and there's humanness pouring out of them, and there's snot, and they're screaming and,
you know,
and crying.
This is such a good sign, because my first few ayahuasca ceremonies, I really literally went in there, I hope I'm not going to be the one crying. I hope I'm not going to be the one puking. I'm going to contain myself no matter what. So, you know, imagine that all of this now, I realize the plant medicine, it's all about, you know, just being yourself, being your authentic self. And we're all human. We're all there. Yeah. The whole space is created to just be there and let that process unfold. And I didn't let it. So I didn't have an experience either with the ayahuasca. It just kind of resisted, you know.
You didn't
and,
let it in.
And then it didn't come through.
It happens. But I think that I think it's so, it's the one of the most healing things we can do as just grown adult humans. Because the like just being there when somebody is really going through it and being okay with it, not trying to help it, not trying to solve it, just being there and being like, yeah, this is being human. And because when do you ever... You know, like at some point I was helping somebody clean up the mess that they'd made from you know, from everything that happened. And they were so embarrassed. And I was like, this is amazing. You know, this is, I'm honored to be a part of this process. Because when the only people that you get to have those, it's almost like an intimate thing to be so close to somebody's struggle. You only have that with your children. If you're lucky, you know, if they're babies. And sometimes with your parents or people that are close to you, if they are in real big trouble, but only if it's like a huge necessity. But it's actually a beautiful gift to be that close to somebody's struggle, to be somebody's suffering, because then you can see that that's real. And the whole mask of normality that we have learned to wear for most of the time in Western world makes us not see each other's humanness. We see each other's roles, clothing, ideas, projections, expectations, it's all a mask. And then you have like one human over here, which is a like a magnificent infinite ball of light and love, and then a human over here, which is a magnificent infinite ball of light and love, and then all of these things in between. And then and they all go like, I'm so and we, we play this whole game with each other. But it's so beautiful to see somebody break open and cry and be vulnerable and to be like, yes, this is also such an important part of life that we don't show each other anymore.
It's good to approach yourself as that you are more than the story you tell yourself, but it's also good that you approach other people that they are more than their behavior. And if so if you do that, and I guess that you also encounter that if you also approach people like the best version of themselves, and then if you start doing that, then you see that people, hey, he doesn't have a judgment, he doesn't have that, so then they can surrender more to the whole training in your situation, or or like in with microdosing also, like if you surrender to that you are human and that you are more than just a story, then you get more out of it, of course.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think this is why it's so important in the first place for people like shamans, people who are leading a ceremony, people who are standing up there. You always have people kind of looking up to you, like you're the master, and you know they're gonna get something from you if you want. So there's like this power relation already, which I think is especially if you're doing this deep work and this ceremony work. It's not the right type of relation.
No.
Because you want someone there who is real and who's gone through the same things and who's in a in essence the same. And then we can all relate and we can really open ourselves, because otherwise there's this this construct still, and these roles are just taking the lead.
And I think that's a very important thing to mention, because we talk about the safety and the normality of these substances and being able to do it, but the unsafety is created by the people and the setting around it, not by the substance itself. It's always human behavior that creates the problem. And it's a very problematic thing in the plant medicine world, where it's growing to a really high degree of popularity, and there's a lot of people that are in it for the money or the power, and that is really not a place where you want to be. And it's rare to find people who are completely pure with it, because you have to be pure with yourself, and nobody's perfect. Yeah. Like, everybody's human. So I think one thing that all of this really teaches is humility. Humility towards the, to understand that there might be, and it's funny because I'm always like, as a biology nerd, biology teacher, if I walk through the forest, I tend to see deeper layers, you know?
Hmm.
And you see somebody stuck on their phone, and they're like, and walking in the forest and screaming into their phone. And I'm like, you have no idea that behind that tree, there's a mushroom growing that is infinitely wiser than you. And it could change everything you think about that conversation you're having right now. You have no idea it's growing there. But to also see that the wisdom, like in the way that trees communicate and the way that the mushrooms communicate, all this stuff, we haven't learned that that is wisdom, that that is something that is greater and smarter than what we are. And I think that is a tremendous gift to receive from all of this work. Is humility, is to realize that at the end of the day, you don't know anything. And you could have an experience tomorrow that could render everything you believe right now irrelevant, or different, at least. And I think that I'm so excited that there's more and more studies to this, because I think that is what should be studied in psychology, and just like, what is a transcendental experience? What happens? And why should we want it? And this is kind of what we started the conversation with, that I think that those experiences are very natural and inherent to being human, to a human life, is to have completely new experiences, different experiences, but also states, altered states of consciousness, in which you can really, really see things differently. Because it's a major gift that we have as humans, that we can actually change our perspective.
Yeah.
Like, most other animals can't do that, as far as we know.
Yeah. And it's funny, and it's so cool that you said this is human. And at the same time, I was thinking inside my mind, but this is actually, you know, spiritual beings having a human experience, or, you know, the classic, or this is actually the soul experiencing itself as a human. That's the other way to look at it. But funnily enough, science is trying now to kind of wrap its head around that. And that's, I think, a beautiful development.
No, but I think it's a great point, and it's very, very helpful for me, and especially in the last few years, to realize that I am a soul having a human experience is great. That's like one of the best perspectives ever. And I my daily practice is also built around that. But from there, also to make the decision to fully embrace the human experience. Because I meet so many spiritual people who bypass it. They go like, oh, but this, all of this grief, it's not even mine. And I'm an infinite soul, and this is not, this can't harm me. Yeah, that's true. But you're having it.
Such so a have it.
That's the same that you, and at some you're point not allowed to have an ego or something. The ego is very functional, and you can learn things or else, to function.
It's like, I don't want to be enlightened, actually. Not yet, at least. Like, I'm having way too much fun having desires and attachments and ego plans and little shit loops that I get into with myself. This is good. I'm very happy to have it.
But on the on the other hand, it's good to touch sometimes that enlightenment state or awakening state. And it all has to do with energy, actually. I find myself like flipping around. It's like into the shadow, out of the shadow. Like, it's a, it's, that's why I was really interested in saving energy. That's also what we learned, what I have gained while microdosing. Like, okay, I am going to save energy, like judging people all the time. That's really an energy waster of time. So
trying to be perfect, trying to live upon other people's expectations.
And especially holding down all of these emotions that you're not supposed to feel. There's so much energy that's like, no, don't feel it. It's like this constant contraction of a muscle. And then, and it's funny because if you're like, and then you tell people, no, just relax. But then relaxing means that I'm going to cry. It's scary. It's very scary. I know what it's like.
but that's all. That helps you balancing your whole life. And
It's so, in the end, I think it's perfectly okay and fine to be this, you know, little scared human who realizes he doesn't know anything. But you know, still moves on, and yeah, we all do the best we can in this time and place. And,
yeah. Definitely. Yeah.
Don't take yourself too seriously. That was one of my first lessons from Carlos Castaneda. I don't know if you know him from, like, in the early days, I was reading all the spiritual books, and that was one of the first I read. And it's like, okay, don't you take yourself too seriously. That was like, okay, I'm going to do that.
Yeah, yeah. my first psychedelic experience is one huge cosmic laugh at all the stuff I read.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like, yeah, that's one of the insights.
Isn't that cute? Isn't that funny? You worry about all these things. Look at what you are. And it's...
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a good... And actually, I had that... well, my first psychedelic experience was actually through breathwork and not even through any external substances. And I always used to get messages like this. You know, I just really deeply be aware of, like, oh, right, all this stuff. And that's also one thing, actually, that I see in benefit of working with breath and microdose or higher doses, is that the breath really allows you to work with the body.
Yeah.
And to open up the body and to move stuck energies. And it's funny, because if you say move stuck energies, that it sounds like spiritual talk. But there's actually scientific frameworks now that really explain what happens there on a physiological level. And that's what I love about breathwork too, is that it connects these worlds now, because it's been so well described from a spiritual perspective and from a scientific perspective. And they're basically saying the exact same thing in different language.
Yeah.
And I think that, and psychedelics have that quality too. And I think that the future of medicine, of psychology, of just well-being and improving yourself will lay in the things that have that commonality between the spiritual. The mystics are saying the same things as the scientists with different words, which means that there is a scientific backing and Western way of looking at these experiences and processes that are seen as more vague and woo-woo. And then that, I think, is really where the major power lives. And I think a lot of the things that have been kind of put in the dark corner of alternative weird hippie shit are going to slowly be coming out of the corner and being scientifically shown how well they actually work. And that's something I'm really excited about.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're already being rebranded now by, people like us, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, but that's what one of our missions was, our goals was that to breaking the stigma of our surrounding psychedelics in general. And microdosing is a great way. I always refer to like a Trojan horse, that people are like, is this a food supplement? They're not scared because you can't get bad trips of it. And now... like a Trojan horse, it's getting into the society and people are talking about it and understanding and really with respect learning how to use this in a very safe way. So that's why we started microdosing and started building a platform, because we knew that community and those kind of things are really important to help break the stigma furthermore.
Well, I think we've been talking for quite a while, but we're now, you mentioned it, microdosing psychedelics, it's gaining more understanding. What do you personally think does the near future look like for these practices and these substances? Like, we know that the legal situation is still very, delicate, actually, in almost everywhere in the world.
Yeah. I think that...
Besides that...
Well... There's two things that I have in mind. One is very optimistic, where I feel like the research is picking up. It's entering the mainstream, so a lot of people are going to have these experiences. They're going to have great experiences, and more people are going to kind of carry this work and see the benefit of it, the value of it. I think it's going to find its way into, well, not necessarily in a doctor's office, but definitely, the more normal therapists are going to see it. And it's just, you can't look away from the body of evidence. And I think it's now also really being embraced. And I feel like it might be the biggest thing in the next 5 years. The less optimistic view that I have is I see the business around it form and greed and all of these things. And the quality of the substances might go down. And I just see like all of these little companies popping up who have really good intentions, because they're like, this is great, it's safe, it's legal, let's just start a truffle business and start sending out truffles. But I think that there is a, there's a danger to it.
Yeah.
And it's with all of this work. And I think it's at one of the psychedelic conferences. I don't know who said it, but it's like one of these legendary quotes of a moment when somebody took the stage and they were like, just don't fuck it up.
Because
it only takes one person to get everything wrong. And that's what has happened with all of the psychedelics.
Yeah. If you look at the 60s, that was the mistake we made in the 60s.
Well, I wasn't there yet.
No.
I was kidding.
But the humans.
Yeah, and if you look at, and this is just something, like I said before, I'm not pro-drugs. I'm just anti-backward thinking and double standards. If you look at all the substances that plant, like natural substances that are psychoactive that have become illegal, and you go into the story of why they have become illegal, it's always like one dumb thing happening. Like even I think it's in Sweden or in one of the Nordic countries where kratom is illegal, and then if I found only one mention of it that said somebody died. They had kratom, cocaine, and alcohol in their system, and a few other things they couldn't really measure. Well, alcohol nobody's going to touch because we love it, and then cocaine was already illegal, so all we can do is illegalize. And the same thing happened with mushrooms in the Netherlands.
In 2009 was exactly the same thing.
And you see that everywhere.
And the independent report of the REVM, who we're listening to now with the COVID situation, they said in the independent report, do not make it illegal, just inform people, educate people more and more, because it's not toxic and not dangerous.
And I think education is really the thing that makes it happen. I used to teach as a biology teacher, drug education. And because I had some bad experiences with addiction and stuff when I was a teenager, I would jump on the scare train with them. Not as much as other teachers, but... And I was looking at this book that we were supposed to use to teach about drugs. And then it had basically alcohol and a whole list of other things, like all the other drugs. And usually they do soft drugs and hard drugs. And then... all the other things basically said, don't do it. This is why it's dangerous. Yeah. And then alcohol had like 4 pages with instructions of how to not die when drinking alcohol. So that means the only reason that we can take alcohol is because in school, isn't that crazy? In school, we learn how to drink alcohol in a way that it doesn't kill us or anybody else. So the difference there is that out of the whole list of substances, alcohol is arguably statistically and physiologically the most dangerous one. But the only reason we get away with it is because we have education.
Yeah.
And that's really what we need.
Yeah.
It's and a the good same thing happened with ayahuasca, by the way. There's only like a few things that happened that looked a little bit dodgy, which was, again, all about the people doing it and not about the substance. And ayahuasca became illegal. And they go like, oh, somebody died on ayahuasca. Nobody ever died from ayahuasca. It's like all of the circumstances around it.
Yeah.
Same thing with iboga, which is still legal. Luckily, because there was also some media circus around it of people dying, which I understand. It's important to pay attention to it.
Yeah.
But imagine we would have, a media circus off of everybody who dies of alcohol.
Yeah, then do we every day people die.
Yeah. It would be the new pandemic, you know.
Yeah.
So I think that I'm very optimistic. I think it's going to do great things. And one thing that makes me very optimistic is all of the states in America that are legalizing or at least decriminalizing.
Yeah.
And I think it would be a very, very important step for the Netherlands to finally at least decriminalize all drugs so that we can actually approach people with actual drug addictions as actual drug addicts who need help instead of criminals and people who use completely perfectly safe medicines for healing, that they are no longer anywhere within the criminal realm, because it's just not correct. But I think the next 4 years, there's not going to change anything on that front. But
well, similar, like what they did in Portugal. You see that the criminal people they go down, less addictive. The money that you spend on war on drugs, you can spend on taking care of people.
Well, you can spend it on education, and you can spend it on educating people to be really good facilitators, to, you know, psychologists who could, you know, make the transition to facilitating people in their plant medicine process and work. And also even with microdosing and with breath, I think this is where the actual, you know, transformation in psychology is actually much better applied than in a lot of the current situations. I'm not saying that that is completely to be disregarded, but to make the shift from pharmaceuticals without any, you know, guidance or therapeutic support to having therapeutic support and occasionally plant medicine, it seems like a much healthier.
So that for the future, I think that's my only concern is that, because I, for example, with ayahuasca, I think the judge who judged the whole case when it became illegal, and even the Santo Daime Church couldn't practice anymore. Somebody told me that one thing that was said by the judge is that, yeah, but there's too many people doing it now and it's becoming too great of a risk. And which to me is not a reason to illegalize it. But that's kind of like the one thing where now there's like all of these truffle companies popping up and everybody's trying to get on it. Where I'm just afraid that 3 years from now, I'm going to be like, it happened again. Like they did again. They found a way to.
Yeah, we find also in our Facebook group and emails that we are a little bit concerned about that, because all those companies, they promise that is the holy grail or the silver bullet, and so that's a lot of people who are depressed or having a burnout. They think, hey, just this is the solution to my problem. I'm gonna microdose. They take too much, different setting, and so we sometimes get emails like, okay, I followed that website and that guidelines, and now I'm stuck, or my expectations were different. So that's what
or even worse, I heard from a friend and I have to get it there, and I got it then I just took it this is the
reason that I only send people to your website. This is because I know that there's education and there's guidance and there's backing. And I even had somebody, because people contact me to help them with their whatever biohacking products or supplement things, and I even had like a few people who were like, I might start selling this. I want to start selling truffles, and I was thinking of selling it as a stack, like add this and add that. What do you think? And I was like, well, what do you think? They're like, oh, I don't know. It's just figured I'd ask the expert. I was like, you're selling this. Why are you not the expert? How do you think you can get away with all of this stuff without knowing about it? And that's in general something that just bothers me, in the way that that people want the results. And for me as well, like I know so many breath coaches who just don't know what's going on. And then they see adverse effects and they explain it away with some spiritual explanation. And it's just because they don't know the science, they don't know the physiology, and it is putting people in danger. It only really takes one bad case of it going wrong. And then, you know, the whole media circus is going to jump on it. And then we lose all of this work that we've been doing.
That's why we also...
And even in the bigger scale in the States, you know, there are so many capital funded companies now with big capital developing all kinds of varieties of psilocybin and of LSD, and just looking for that thing so that they can patent it and that they have their own. And then ideally, it's not too psychoactive. So ideally, it's like a new antidepressant to bring on the market that doesn't need to come with any education or any guidance, because that is the model, of course, that is the most profitable business model. So yeah, this also is...
But I definitely feel like we're on a... I don't know where it's going, but I feel I have a lot of trust in the future.
When we the authentic way that people will filter it out, who is playing like a role of not bad actors, but companies who just want to make money, or people who want to just educate people so they do it in a safe way. And that's why we also are involved with the Guild of Guides, like an independent association for truffle retreats that everybody works with some kind of a standard, a code of ethics. And we also want to set that up for microdosing coaches, just to, in collaboration with Jim Fadiman, just to give like a basics, what everybody needs to know and
a framework and a certain level of expertise and ethics to apply to this work. Okay, is there anything else that you would like to share with our listeners, with the world, before we wrap up? Is there anything you feel like you touched upon so many great subjects? Anything that you feel is missing?
There's nothing specific coming, but I have a standard answer there. I like to remind people that they're going to die. It's a very important one. Yeah, like everything we've talked about matters because life will end.
Yeah,
and it might end very soon.
Yeah,
and whatever you can do to experience everything out of this experience that you have here is important. And I think remembering, like, we can talk about all of this and you can think about it and you can, but in the end, life, this life that we have now in this human form at least will end. And I just, at every opportunity that I have, I like to remind people of that. What does that mean to you? And and my, well, actually, so one thing that I came up with, which might be the title to my next book, is Microdosing Death. So to have daily reminders of death in your in your day. And so mentally, by like every night I ask myself the question, or well, every night, but I try to ask myself the question, and if I'm I'm about to close my eyes, what if this is the last time I close my eyes? And how do I feel about my day and about my life? Am I ready to die? Have I lived my life fully? And if I get a no, then it's going to take some questioning to myself to wonder what I'd do differently tomorrow to get a yes tomorrow. So that's one. And then also facing yourself with extreme cold, with extreme heat, with a breath hold, with a low amount of oxygen, a high amount of CO2, all of these things are fasting. All of these are little micro versions of reminding the body that it will die. And it triggers this response to be more resilient, more present, more aware. And I think, that's just a very important part of my practice that I like to share with people.
And I know that recently a book came out which is called The Immortality Key that speaks completely about this. Like, we have to die before we die, because then we know what it what it's like. Then we start to really live.
Amazing.
It's
it helped me in the early days. Like, okay, death is the my advisor. Like, if you're constantly aware that you can die tomorrow, then you are getting the most out of your life. And
I think that's an ancient Egypt saying, right? We have to die before we die, otherwise we won't have truly lived, or something like that. I have to look it up.
I think this is all in this book. I cannot pronounce the name of the writer, Brian something, but let's post it in the comments.
Immortality Key.
It's the book, and it also explains in early ancient Egypt and biblical ages, like, actually the role of psychedelics and the psychedelic experience that comes into the book. It's like interweaven into, because it is there. You can kind of read between the lines of all of those early scripts, and it's there. Just nobody seems to know what it really was, and in what kind of, was it a substance? Was it a thing they
Well,
did?
If you ask Terence McKenna, he had a pretty clear idea.
So it's, it's always been amongst us. To wrap up, Casper, where can people find you, and what do you have to offer, and how to get there?
I have a coach's certification program called breathworkmasterclass.com. That's a place to find that part of my education. And then other than that, on Instagram is where I'm most active, at Casper's Focus, and people can find me there. And I have a little link in my bio where people can enter the email address and get a bunch of free breathing techniques to follow online. And so, that's where people can go.
Great. Perfect. Yeah. And if you sign up for the Breathwork Masterclass through our link, there is a discount specifically. So we're going to add that link and code
discount,
as well.
Yeah.
Yes.
All right.
15%, is it right? Yes. Correct. Okay, got it. I didn't want to say it.
15.
Perfect. Well, this was lovely. Thank you, Casper.
Thank you. Yeah.